70 years ago, I was in high school. Almost a third as long as the country has been around. And when I was in high school, I really only had two things on my mind. Girls and cars. And I wasn't doing very well with girls, so we'll talk about cars. But let's just imagine that when we finish, I'm going to let each one of you pick out the car of your choice. Sounds good, doesn't it? Pick it out, any color, you name it, it'll be tied up with a bow, and it'll be at your house tomorrow. And you say, well, what's the catch? And the catch is that it's the only car you're going to get in your lifetime. Now, what are you going to do knowing that that's the only car you're ever going to have and you love that car? You're going to take care of it like you cannot believe. Now, what I'd like to suggest, you're not going to get only one car in your lifetime, but you're going to get one body and one mind, and that's all you're going to get. And that body and mind feels terrific now, but it has to last you a lifetime.
Want to be happy? Build a life, not just a business. Hey, it's Evan Carmichael, and this channel is created to help you overcome the number one challenge that is holding you back, a lack of belief in yourself. You watch these videos because you know there's something more inside you too. You've got Michael Jordan level genius at something. So today, let's live your best believe life and get some amazing insights from Warren Buffett. Rule number two, never give up.
You rejected by Harvard, you went to Columbia Business School, and then you met the man who you really idolized, Ben Graham. And when you took his class, was he as great as you had thought he was going to be?
He really was. He only taught one semester, one class. I mean, he came up from Wall Street and taught this class. That's the reason I went to Columbia. And I knew I'd already read all the books and everything. But it was inspirational just to be around him, and it made a real difference in my life.
So when you graduated, you wanted to go work for him and his firm, and then he rejected you. For an interesting reason. In those days, I understand that there were Jewish firms and non-Jewish firms, and his was a Jewish firm, and you weren't Jewish, so he said because you weren't Jewish, he didn't hire you. Is that right?
That's true. He's, and I was ready to convert, believe me. I think they might have felt it was a little phony at the time. But it was true that there were very few firms in Wall Street that would hire Jews at that time, and Ben only employed five or six people. But he told me to the extent that they had were able to employ five or six people, he really felt that the Jews could not get into most jobs in Wall Street and that they were going to employ only Jews.
You moved back for a while to Nebraska, but then he ultimately changed his mind and you went to work for Ben Graham.
I kept pestering him. Yeah, I made a real pest of myself.
Rule number three, choose love over wealth.
How would you define true success?
Well, I've said many times that if you get to be 65 or 70 and later, and the people that you want to have love you actually do love you, you're a success. I've never seen anybody that reaches that age. I mean, I'm not talking about somebody that's in extreme poverty or pain or something, but I've never seen anybody that, if they have a lot of people that love them, that is other than happy. And I've seen some very, very wealthy people that they give testimonial dinners to and name schools after and everything. Nobody loves them.
Rule number four, be determined to succeed.
I would like to tell you of two women that each sold a business to Berkshire Hathaway, to me actually, for many, many, many millions of dollars. Both of them started with $2,500. By a coincidence, it was the exact same amount. It was everything they had in the world. And one of them was a woman who landed in Seattle in 1917, couldn't speak a word of English, had a tag around her neck. The tag said, Fort Dodge, Iowa. The Red Cross got her to Fort Dodge, where she was reunited with her husband who had come to the country a couple of years earlier. And she lived in Fort Dodge for 2 years, and as she put it, she felt like a dummy. She couldn't pick up the language. She couldn't learn a word. And so she and her husband decided to move to Omaha.
So they came to Omaha in 1919, and there she found a small colony of Russian Jews, so she started feeling more at home. And then as her oldest daughter went to school, she would come home, this daughter, Frances, and she would teach her mother the words she'd learned in school that day. And this woman, Rose Blumpkin, spent 20 years saving money, bringing first her siblings over, her mother and father, $50 at a time. She sold used clothing to do it. She had four children during this period. And by 1937, after 20 years, she'd saved $2,500. She went to Chicago and she bought what she could of furniture. Her dream had always been to open a furniture store. And this woman, who had never gone to school one day in her life, with $2,500, but with the same spirit that the people in this room had about having a dream and working to accomplish that dream, she built a business which she sold to me in 1983 for $60 million approximately, and which did $1.5 billion worth of business last year. The fourth generation is working in that business. This woman, Rose Blumpkin, lived, well, she worked for me until she was 103. And then she retired and she died the next year, which is a lesson to all of Berkshire's managers that premature retirement, you know, nothing, you can't tell what's going to happen. But Mrs. B, with her $2,500, one further fact about her, she could not read or write. And she went into a furniture business, and she didn't bring anything in unique in furniture, but she brought a determination to succeed. She knew she could outwork anyone else. She knew that she cared about her customers. She worked at very low gross margins, but she built this incredible business.
Rule number five, invest in yourself.
By far the best investment you can make is in yourself. I mean, for example, communication skills. I tell the students that come that they're going to graduate schools and business, and they're learning all these complicated formulas and all that. If they just learn to communicate better, and both in writing and in person, they increase their value at least 50%. And I mean, if you can't communicate, somebody says, you know, it's like winking at a girl in the dark. Nothing happens, you know, basically. And you have to be able to get forth your ideas. And that's relatively easy. I did it myself with a Dale Carnegie course. Some people wish I'd taken a shorter course now in terms of my talking later on. But it's just hugely important. And if you invest in yourself, nobody can take it away from you.
Rule number six, define your circle of competence.
I have an old-fashioned belief that I can only should expect to make money in things that I understand. And when I say understand, I don't mean understand, you know, what the product does or anything like that. I mean understand what the economics of the business are likely to look like 10 years from now or 20 years from now. I know, in general, what the economics of, say, Wrigley chewing gum will look like 10 years from now. The internet isn't going to change the way people chew gum. It isn't going to change which gum they chew. You know, if you own the chewing gum market in a big way, and you've got Double Mint and Spearmint and Juicy Fruit, those brands will be there 10 years from now. So I can't pinpoint exactly what the numbers are going to look like on Wrigley, but I'm not going to be way off if I try to look forward on something like that. That evaluating that company is within what I call my circle of competence. I understand what they do, I understand the economics of it, I understand the competitive aspects of the business. Figuring out the economic consequences, TV. I think there's, I don't know, 20, 25 million sets a year sold in the United States. I don't think there's one of them made in the United States anymore. I mean, you'd say TV set manufacturer, what a wonderful business. I mean, everybody, you know, nobody had a TV in 1950, or thereabouts, 45 to 50. Everybody has multiple sets now. Nobody in the United States has made any real money
making the sense that they're all out of business. You know, the Magnavoxes, the RCAs, all of those companies. Radio was the equivalent in the 20s. Over 500 companies making radios in the 1920s. Again, I don't think there's a U.S. radio manufacturer at the present time. But Coca-Cola, you know, what was it, 1884, at Jacob's Pharmacy or whatever, the fellow comes up with something. A lot of copiers over the years. But now you've got a company that is selling roughly 1.1 billion 8-ounce servings of its product, not all Cokes, Sprite, and some others, daily throughout the world 117 years later. So understanding the economic characteristics of a business is different than predicting the fact that an industry is going to do wonderfully. And so when I look at the internet businesses, or I look at tech businesses, I say this is a marvelous thing, and I love to play around on the computer, and now I order my books from Amazon and all kinds of things, but I don't know who's going to win. And unless I know who's going to win, I'm not interested in investing. I'll just play around on the computer. And defining your circle of competence is the most important aspect of investing. It's not how important, how large your circle is. You don't have to be an expert on everything. But knowing where the perimeter of that circle of what you know and what you don't know is, and staying inside of it, is all important. Tom Watson Sr., who started IBM, said in his book, he said, "I'm no genius," he said, "but I'm smart in spots, and I stay around those spots." And you know, that is the key. So if I understand a few things, and I stick in that arena, I'll do okay. And if I don't understand something, but I get all excited about it because my neighbors are talking about it, and the stocks are going up and everything, they start fooling around someplace else, eventually I'll get creamed, and I should.
Rule number 7, the light customers.
Henry Ford, as you may know, failed twice before he started the Ford Motor Company in 1903. I mean, the test isn't whether you get the greatest business idea in the world the first time out. The test is whether you keep learning as you go along what your strengths are and what you can do for your customers, what you can bring especially to the party. And to do that, you need a genuine desire day in, day out to delight the customer. I've never seen a business, and I've seen a lot of businesses, but I've never seen one that delights the customer that doesn't succeed. I mean, what you want is that customer the next day when they think, do I want to rent a car or do I want to buy some furniture? What goes through their mind? You know, it's the place where they've had a great experience. I don't know what I paid for this type. Actually, probably if somebody gave it to me, but for the purposes of this speech, I will say, I have no idea, but what I, or the shirt I'm wearing, or this, but I do know, I will remember how I was treated when I bought it. I mean, you long forget about the price, but you never forget whether you had a good experience or a poor experience with the purchase experience.
Rule number 8, have the right framework.
I was wondering if you have any stock tips for any of the students, you know, we're all trying to make a little living.
I didn't think they taught that at Georgetown. the best investment I ever made, well, I bought a book in 1949 by a fellow named Ben Graham called The Intelligent Investor. I don't remember what I paid. But aside from what I paid for my two marriage licenses, that was the best investment I ever made. It's very important to have the right framework. You need to have an approach to investing that's sound. And Graham's approach is simple, but some people adopt to it, which I did immediately, and most people don't. But if you have the right philosophy, you will find opportunities as you go through the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years. And frankly, you're most likely to find them when in periods like 5 years ago when we were having the panic. I mean, stocks sell at silly prices from time to time. Most stocks at one time or another sell at very silly prices. And it doesn't take a high IQ to figure out that they're cheap, But it does take a temperament that's willing to step up and actually act. I tell people, if they're going into the investment business, if you got 160 IQ, sell 30 points to somebody else, because you won't need it. I mean, I figured out very early, you don't have to be that smart in this business, which is fortunate, but you do have to have the right temperament. And you have to be able to ignore what other people are saying and simply look at the facts and decide, is this stock which is selling at X worth 2X? And occasionally you'll find things like that. And when you don't find them, you don't do anything. So that's my generalized stock tip, no names.
Rule number 9, read biographies.
I should mention one thing about reading. It was at the library here at Columbia, that I wish I spent probably more time than any other student. I lived there practically. But you know, I pulled the book out there, happened to be Who's Who in America, and it told me something about my professor, Benjamin Graham. And then I looked up and I went to the library and I said, I want to learn more about this because I learned this over here. Mm-hmm. That changed my whole life. You know, we own Geico now because of that librarian directing me to some other book and then following through on that. The chance, I read about one-fifth the pace that Bill does, but I still spend 5 or 6 hours a day reading. I mean, it just, you can learn so much. I particularly love biography, just you know, to be able to live the lives of these people that have been so, see them so extraordinary, the lessons and the, you know, the discouragements they face, just everything about it. So you can't get enough of reading.
Rule number 10, conquer your fears.
Somebody once said that the chains of habit are too light to be felt until they're too heavy to be broken. I had been terrified of public speaking. I couldn't do it. I'd throw up. And I knew if I didn't cure it then, I'd never cure it. And so I saw an ad in the paper for the Dale Carnegie course, which worked on developing your ability to speak in public. And I went down there.
Be sincere. A good smile has the same effect as a puppy's tail. When a puppy wags...
They made us do all these crazy things to get out of ourselves, and so we stood on tables and did all kinds of things. If I hadn't have done that, my whole life would have been different. So in my office, you will not see the degree I got from the University of Nebraska. You'll not see the master's degree I got from Columbia University, but you'll see the little award certificate I got from the Dale Carnegie course.
Rule number 11, do what you love.
How would you advise people who aren't necessarily going into a career field in which you would make a large base salary, such as like medicine or something like that, maybe performing arts or music? How would you advise us to keep up financially with the rest of the world?
Well, it is true that a market system does not pay as well in some activities as might seem appropriate for the importance of those activities to society. Just take teaching, for example. I mean, teaching does not pay well. And what could be more important? I mean, you've got to be as interested in who you're... The teachers of your children are as who your accountant is, or you know, whatever, or who's winning the heavyweight title of the world, or that sort of thing. But it doesn't pay well, and it's a fundamental choice whether you're going to go into something. For many people, it'd be a fundamental choice whether you're going to go into something you love or something to try and make a lot of money. I think that generally it pays to go with what you love. I think that. It's very hard to find people when they get to be my age who say that they've loved what they've done all their life and feel it was very worthwhile, but they're terribly sad they made that choice because they didn't make a lot of money. I don't think anybody's ever said that to me, that they wish they'd gone into something else where they were uncomfortable doing it or didn't enjoy it, didn't feel very productive, but made a lot of money. So I don't think you'll find that. So I would go to work. I would go to work in whatever turns you on. It may turn out that it'll be more profitable than you can think, but almost everybody here will make enough money, unless they get some terrible habits along the way, to do reasonably well. And doing reasonably well in this country really is is pretty darn good. I mean, it's not necessary to have huge amounts of money in order to enjoy yourself. I enjoyed myself when I was had my $10,000, and I live in the same house that I lived in when I was making it, when I had about that. I bought it 41 years ago. I liked the house then. I like the house now. I mean, if you think about it, if you have a reasonable job, you'll be eating at McDonald's, and I'll be eating at McDonald's. So we're to push on food. I mean, you know, I hope it's Dairy Queen, actually. And and if you come to Dairy Queen, you'll see me. And you can order anything on the menu I can order, and we both can afford it. You know, you'll wear the same clothes I wear. I'll pay more for my suits, but as soon as I put them on, they look cheap on me. So we'll look about the same. We'll both live in the same kind of houses. I live in that house from 41 years ago, and it's warm in winter, and it's cool in summer, and it's comfortable. And you'll live in a house that's similar. And what difference does it make if you have 50 more rooms, or, you know, guest houses, or all that? It'll probably just bring you problems. I mean, you have to worry about the greenskeeper or something when you get through. So I have been in the houses of people where the houses are worth probably 200 times what my house is worth, and I would not be any happier in those houses at all. In fact, I'd be less happy. I just have one more thing to worry about, and, you know, the dozens of people around the place, and people quitting, and people stealing from you, and all kinds of things. To hell with it. You know? We'll drive the same kind of car. In fact, you'll probably drive a better car. I drive a car that's about 8 years old. I don't know what it's worth now, but it gets me around fine. I mean, I'm perfectly happy. We'll watch the same television, you know. We'll work on the same computer pretty much. The only difference will be how we travel long distances. You know, I will fly in a plane that's more comfortable than flying Southwest Airlines or something, which I've got nothing against. But that's the one real big difference. And other than that, I do what I like every day. I hope you'll do what you like every day to do. And I work with nice people. I hope you work with nice people. There's 24 hours in the day, and those are where the hours go. So great wealth is the tiniest bit different in a real sense than having just a decent income. And to trade a decent income and something you love doing and something where you feel worthwhile doing it for huge wealth where you trade off a lot of your principles would be a terrible mistake.
And rule number 12, the last one before some very special bonus clips, is have discipline.
You don't need 150 IQ to do what I do, thank God. You know, you don't need 140, you don't need 135. You may need 115 or something like that. But you do need discipline. You have to wait until you see the fat pitch to swing at. Because investing is a no-called strike game. You know, if I were a baseball player and I only like pitches 2 inches above my navel, you know, some guy could learn that and he could pitch me, you know, 3 or 4 inches below that, and I get called out on strikes because I never find a pitch I like. You can get called out on strikes in baseball. You have to swing at pitches that you don't even necessarily like, particularly after the count gets to 2 strikes. In business, you don't have to swing at anything. You can sit there and the paper says General Motors at 68, or it says General Electric at 115, or it says General Dynamics at 63. And if you don't like those prices, you don't have to swing. You can wait there day after day after day after day, and there are no called strikes. Now, when you swing, when you decide to buy something, then, you know, if you swing and miss, it's a strike. But it's a marvelous game to be in because there are no called strikes, and you can simply wait for that one time in a month or 6 months or a year or 2 or 3 years when you really know what you're doing, where you like the price, where you like the people running the business. And then you swing, and you only need a few swings in your lifetime. There's a company here in Washington called Geico, you know, and I first got exposed to that in 1950. I was 20 years old, and I came down here, and I came down on a Saturday because I learned that my professor, who I worshipped at Columbia, named Ben Graham, was the chairman. I got down here and the door was locked. When I went to the building, because it was Saturday, and I pounded on the door and some janitor let me in, and a marvelous fellow named Lorimer Davidson spent 4 hours with me teaching me all about insurance, and he helped me so much in life. You're gonna get helped by some wonderful people in life. It's a great thing to
to remember later on when you get to be my age that, you know, all the help you've received from different people, because nobody does it alone. Obama got in trouble when he said that in the campaign, that, you know, nobody does it by themselves. Nobody does do it by themselves. We all sit in the shade of trees that were planted by others, so it's obligatory, I think, to plant a few trees ourselves if we've had good luck. It's been a great ride, but it's not over.
All of you in this room have the brains to do extremely well in life. You've all got the energy to do extremely well in life, and then the question is, how do you apply it? If you've got a 200 horsepower motor, do you get 200 horsepower out of it? Do you get your full potential, or do you get 100 horsepower or 50 horsepower? Now, there's two things that can hold you back in getting the full horsepower out of your engine, whatever it may be. All of you have big enough engines. And one of those is a lack of education, but that probably isn't going to happen to very many people in this room. If you did have a lack of education, if you didn't have a chance to get a decent education in life, it wouldn't make any difference what that potential was, because you'd never unlock it. But the second most important thing, and equally as important, is in terms of the habits that you develop, in terms of what you do with yourself. When we hire people, we look for three qualities. We look for integrity, we look for intelligence, and we look for energy. But if they don't have the first one, integrity, the other two will kill you. Because if you're hiring somebody without integrity, you really want them to be dumb and lazy, don't you? I mean, you know, the last thing in the world you want for them is to be smart and energetic. So smart and energetic only goes with integrity. But the nice thing,
you know, you make your own decision on that. You can't change your IQ or how far you can throw a football or how high you can jump or the color of your hair very easily. But you can elect to have integrity that matches anybody else's. And if you match that with intelligence, which you have, and energy, which you have, you will get an extraordinary result, and you'd be very foolish to sell me 10% of yourself for $50,000. On the other hand, if you don't match it with that, your potential will, in a significant part, go unused.
How would you advise people who aren't necessarily going into a career field in which you would make a large base salary, such as like medicine or something like that, maybe performing arts or music? How would you advise us to keep up financially with the rest of the world?
Well, it is true that a market system does not pay as well in some activities as might seem appropriate for the importance of those activities to society. Just take teaching, for example. I mean, teaching does not pay well. And what could be more important? I mean, you've got to be as interested in who your the teachers of your children are as who your accountant is, or, you know, whatever, or who's winning the heavyweight title of the world, or that sort of thing. But it doesn't pay well. And it's a fundamental choice whether you're going to go into something, for many people, it'd be a fundamental choice whether you're going to go into something you love or something to try and make a lot of money. I think that generally it pays to go with what you love. I think that it's very hard to find people when they get to be my age who say that they've loved what they've done all their life and feel it was very worthwhile, but they're terribly sad they made that choice because they didn't make a lot of money. I don't think anybody's ever said that to me, that they wish they'd gone into something else where they were uncomfortable doing it or didn't enjoy it, didn't feel very productive, but made a lot of money. So I don't think you'll find that. So I would go to work. I would go to work in whatever turns you on. It may turn out that it'll be more profitable than you can think, but almost everybody here will make enough money, unless they get some terrible habits along the way, to do reasonably well. And doing reasonably well in this country really is pretty darn good. I mean, it's not necessary to have huge amounts of money in order to enjoy yourself. I enjoyed myself when I had my $10,000, and I live in the same house that I lived in when I had about that. I bought it 41 years ago. I liked the house then. I like the house now. I mean, if you think about it, if you have a reasonable job you'll be eating at McDonald's and I'll be eating at McDonald's. So we're to push on food. I mean, you know, I hope it's Dairy Queen, actually. And if you come to Dairy Queen, you'll see me. And you can order anything on the menu I can order, and we both can afford it. You'll wear the same clothes I wear. I'll pay more for my suits, but as soon as I put them on, they look cheap on me. So we'll look about the same. We'll both live in the same kind of houses. I live in that house from 41 years ago, and it's warm in winter, and it's cool in summer, and it's comfortable. And you'll live in a house that's similar. And what difference does it make if you have 50 more rooms or, you know, guest houses or all that? It'll probably just bring you problems. I mean, you have to worry about the greenskeeper or something when you get through. So I have been in the houses of people where the houses are worth probably 200 times what my house is worth, and I would not be any happier in those houses at all. In fact, I'd be less happy. I just have one more thing to worry about, and, you know, the dozens of people around the place and people quitting and people stealing from you and all kinds of things. To hell with it. You know? We'll drive the same kind of car. In fact, you'll probably drive a better car. I drive a car that's about 8 years old. I don't know what it's worth now, but it gets me around fine. I mean, I'm perfectly happy with it. We'll watch the same television, you know. We'll work on the same computer pretty much. The only difference will be how we travel long distances, you know. I will fly in a plane that's more comfortable than flying Southwest Airlines or something, which I've got nothing against. But that's the one real big difference. And other than that, I do what I like every day. I hope you'll do what you like every day to do. And I work with nice people. I hope you work with nice people. And there's 24 hours in the day, and those are where the hours go. So great wealth is the tiniest bit different in a real sense than having just a decent income. And to trade a decent income and something you love doing and something where you feel worthwhile doing it for huge wealth where you trade off a lot of your principles would be a terrible mistake.
I was wondering if you have any stock tips for any of the students. You know, we're all trying to make a little living.
I didn't think they taught that at Georgetown. the best investment I ever made, well, I bought a book in 1949 by a fellow named Ben Graham called The Intelligent Investor. I don't remember what I paid. But aside from what I paid for my two marriage licenses, that was the best investment I ever made. It's very important to have the right framework. You need to have an approach to investing that's sound. And Graham's approach is simple, but some people adopt to it, and which I did immediately, and most people don't. But if you have the right philosophy, you will find opportunities as you go through the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years. And frankly, you're most likely to find them when in periods like 5 years ago when we were having the panic. I mean, stocks sell at silly prices from time to time. Most stocks at one time or another sell at very silly prices. And it doesn't take a high IQ to figure out that they're cheap, but it does take a temperament that's willing to step up and actually act. I tell people, if they're going in the investment business, if you got 160 IQ, sell 30 points to somebody else because you won't need it. I mean, I figured out very early, you don't have to be that smart in this business, which is fortunate, but you do have to have the right temperament, and you have to be able to ignore what other people are saying and simply look at the facts and decide, is this stock which is selling at X worth 2X? And occasionally you'll find things like that, and when you don't find them, you don't do anything. So that's my generalized stock tip, no name.
Well, in 1973, the Washington Post company had gone public in 1971, right about the Pentagon Papers time. But in 73, the Nixon administration was through Bebe Rebozo, who was a pal of Nixon's, they were challenging the licenses of two of the Florida television stations the Post owned. So the stock went from 37 down to 16. Now, at 16, there were about 5 million shares outstanding. So the whole Washington Post company was selling for $80 million. And that included the newspaper, four big TV stations, Newsweek, you know, and some other assets, and no debt to speak of. So the Washington Post company, which was intrinsically worth $400 or $500 million, was selling for about $80 million in the market. We bought most of our stock at about the equivalent of $100 million in the market. And it was ridiculous. I mean, you had a business that unquestionably was worth four or five times what it was selling for, and Nixon wasn't going to put them out of business.
When you're doing these analyses then and now, do you have computers that help you, or how did you actually read all, where do you just get printed materials, or how did you in those days get the materials to read about the Washington Post, and how do you do it today?
Well, same, pretty much the same way, except there's fewer opportunities now. But I met Bob Woodward back, and he just come out with All the President's Men, and all of a sudden, as a below 30 years of age, he was getting quite wealthy, and we had breakfast or lunch over at the Madison Hotel, and he said, "What do I do with this money?" And I said, "Investing is just about assigning yourself the right story." I said, "Imagine Ben Bradley this morning said to you, 'What is the Washington Post Company worth?' What would you do if you have to write the story in a month? You'd go out and interview TV brokers and newspaper brokers and owners, and you'd try and value each asset." I said, "That's what I do. I assign myself the right story, and it's nothing more than that." Now, there's some stories I can't write. If you ask me to write a story on, you know, what is some glamorous but nonprofit making business worth, I don't know how to write that story. But if you ask me to write a story on what is Potomac Electric Power worth or something like that, I can write the story. And that's what I'm doing every day. I'm assigning myself a story, and then I go out. Everything you do learn is cumulative. I mean, that doesn't mean that industries stay good forever or businesses stay good forever, but learning to think about business models. What I learned at 20 is useful to me now. What I learned at 25 is useful to me now. And so it's not a field that changes dramatically in terms of the underlying principles. It's like physics. I mean, there's underlying principles. Now, they're doing all kinds of things with physics they weren't doing 50 years ago. But if you know if you got the principles, if you know what makes a good business, if you know what makes a good manager, you know, if you know what makes a good product, and you learn that in one business, there is some transference to other businesses as you go along, and you learn what things you're not going to understand. I mean, knowing what to leave out is just as important as knowing what to focus on. I don't think I can win every game. You know, somebody said, "How do you beat Bobby Fischer? You play him any game except chess." See? So I don't play Bobby Fischer chess. And there's a lot of value to learning that over time, and learning what you're good at and what you're not good at. You will move in the direction of the people that you associate with. So it's important to associate with people that are better than yourself. And actually, the most important decision many of you make, not all of you, will be the spouse you choose. Right. And you want to associate with people who are the kind of person you'd like to be. You'll move in that direction. And the most important person by far in that respect is your spouse. I can't overemphasize how important that is. And you're right. The friends you have, they will form you as you go through life. And make some good friends, keep them for the rest of your life, but have them be people that you admire as well as like.
Over the years, I've developed a better understanding of human nature. I can learn a lot about investments out of a book, but I don't think you can learn as much about human beings. You really need some experiences, and I'm wiser in that respect than I was 40 or 50 years ago, even though I can't rattle off numbers the same way I used to be able to.
I have an old-fashioned belief that I can only should expect to make money in things that I understand. And when I say understand, I don't mean understand, you know, what the product does or anything like that. I mean, understand what the economics of the business are likely to look like 10 years from now or 20 years from now. I know, in general, what the economics of, say, Wrigley chewing gum will look like 10 years from now. The internet isn't going to change the way people chew gum. It isn't going to change which gum they chew. You know, if you own the chewing gum market in a big way, and you've got Double Mint and Spearmint and Juicy Fruit, those brands will be there 10 years from now. So I can't pinpoint exactly what the numbers are going to look like on Wrigley, but I'm not going to be way off if I try to look forward on something like that. That evaluating that company is within what I call my circle of competence. I understand what they do. I understand the economics of it. I understand the competitive aspects of the business. Figuring out the economic consequences, TV. I think there's, I don't know, 20, 25 million sets a year sold in the United States. I don't think there's one of them made in the United States anymore. I mean, you'd say TV set manufacturer, what a wonderful business. I mean, everybody, you know, nobody had a TV in 1950, or thereabouts, 45 to 50. Everybody has multiple sets now, but nobody is in the United States has made any real money making the sets. They're all out of business. You know, the Magnavoxes, the RCAs, all of those companies. Radio was the equivalent in the 20s. Over 500 companies making radios in the 1920s. Again, I don't think there's a U.S. radio manufacturer at the present time. But Coca-Cola, you know, what was it, 1884, at Jacob's Pharmacy or whatever, the fellow comes up with something. A lot of copiers over the years. But now you've got a company that is selling roughly 1.1 billion 8-ounce servings of its product, not all Cokes, Sprite, and some others, daily throughout the world 117 years later. So understanding the economic characteristics of a business is different than predicting the fact that an industry is going to do wonderfully. And so when I look at the internet businesses or I look at tech businesses, I say this is a marvelous thing and I love to play around on the computer and now I order my books from Amazon and all kinds of things, but I don't know who's going to win. And unless I know who's going to win, I'm not interested in investing. I'll just play around on the computer. And defining your circle of competence is the most important aspect of investing. It's not how important, how large your circle is. You don't have to be an expert on everything. But knowing where the perimeter of that circle of what you know and what you don't know is and staying inside of it is all important. Tom Watson Sr., who started IBM, said in his book, he said, "I'm no genius," he said, "but I'm smart in spots and I stay around those spots." And you know, that is the key. So if I understand a few things and I stick in that arena, I'll do okay. And if I don't understand something, but I get all excited about it because my neighbors are talking about it and the stocks are going up and everything, they start fooling around someplace else, eventually I'll get creamed, and I should.
If you look around the world at the people that succeed and the people that other people want to work with, the natural leaders, it isn't because they have the highest IQ or they can kick a football the furthest or anything like that. They're people that you want to work with. I mean, I've got a wonderful friend named Tom Murphy. You know, I would do anything for him. You know, he's never going to ask me to do it, but I mean, I want it. But I want to do it. I mean, I want to do it. I mean, he's done so many things for me, and you know, you know, he doesn't have to pay me to do it or anything of the sort. That's what you want to look for that, and you want to be that.
You will move in the direction of the people that you associate with. So it's important to associate with people that are better than yourself. And actually, the most important decision many of you make, not all of you, will be the spouse you choose.
Right.
And you want to associate with people who are the kind of person you'd like to be. You'll move in that direction. And the most important person by far in that respect is your spouse. I can't overemphasize how important that is. And you're right. The friends you have, they will form you as you go through life. And make some good friends, keep them for the rest of your life, but have them be people that you admire as well as like.
I was very lucky in life. If you tell me who your heroes are, I will make a pretty good prediction about what you're going to do. And I had the right heroes. I was very lucky in life, and my heroes never let me down, and started with my dad, and then I had others in business. And so I have had great teachers, some formal teachers, some that were just informal teachers, teachers by instinct or example. And if I hadn't had those, my life, I'm sure, would have been very different.
If success is contingent on a good plan, excellent education and execution, and a driven mindset, what do you think makes businesses fall apart when all of these factors have been met? And go ahead.
Some businesses are just tough. I mean, a significant percentage, you know, of the restaurants that open up this year are going to fail. I mean, there are a lot of tough businesses. I've always said, if you want to be regarded as a great business person, find a great business. And there's a huge difference. I mean, it does make a difference. I, use this analogy. When I got out of Columbia, one of my best friends was a terrific talent. And he went to work in the steel business, and he did okay, but it was the wrong business to be in. It's very important to get on the right train. Mm-hmm. I mean, you want to get on a train that's going to go 90 miles an hour, right, and not one that's going to go 30 miles an hour, and you're going to try to figure out how to, you know, push it along a little faster.
Right.
So it really does make a huge difference. And there are some businesses that are inherently, there's far more opportunity in than others. So you want to give a lot of thought to what train you're getting on. And I owned a half interest when I was, I don't know, 21 or 22, in a service station, a Sinclair service station with a pal of mine in the National Guard. It was a lousy business. You know, we had a guy right next to us, and he kept selling more gallons of gas than we did. He would cut our prices and everything. I mean, I don't care if, you know, if you're a combination of Steve Jobs and Larry Ellison and everybody else. You're not going to succeed if you got a guy selling gas below cost next to you. So, you know, it's important to get on the right train.
What are the best ways for youth to get started now in securing their financial future?
For what, to secure their financial future?
For youth. For youth.
Youth? Oh. Well, it's not very complicated. It goes back to getting full use out of your own talents first. I mean, the difference between whether you're going to be earning X or 2X or 3X a year 20 years from now is going to be a function of how well, not how much talent you have, but how well you use the talents you already have. And so that is your best financial future is your own ability and your a capacity to use those abilities to their potential. And they can't can't be taken away from you. They can't even tax it. I mean, you know, most things, if you own a piece of real estate, if they double the taxes, they double the taxes, and that changes your ownership in the property, because now, in effect, the taxing authorities own more of it because they've got a greater command on the revenue stream. The same thing about almost any asset you have, but they don't tax what's in your head, and they don't tax your ability to start performing when you get to work in the morning and finish in the evening to your potential. One of the things that amazes me is how people who really do perform well just sort of jump out at you once you're running a business. When I got out of school, I thought, you know, everybody would behave that way, but they don't. Most people sort of go through life in a sleepwalk, and if you don't, you will stand out. So the biggest thing for your financial future is yourself.
What do you think the lessons are of the last couple of cycles that you've seen from an investor standpoint? We've got a lot of young kids out there. You've lived through multiple cycles in the 50, 60 years plus you've been investing,
yeah.
70 years,
70
of
years
investing.
Yeah.
Investing. What are the lessons, and what, you know, these are young people, what should they take away?
The lessons are that people will continue to make the same mistakes they've made. I mean, it doesn't correlate to IQ particularly. I mean, when they get greedy, and we had this huge bubble in the most important asset the American public has, housing. I mean, so you had a huge bubble in something that you could borrow heavily against. So you could run a margin account effect on a house instead of stocks, and the conditions got very lax. And so when that bubble popped, but people came into that gradually. When they get fearful, it happens all at once. I mean, when people get scared, they all want to leave at one time. And we had them all want to leave at one time, and that'll happen again. It'll happen with a different set of circumstances, but the human animal will keep behaving pretty much the way it has in the past. So we will have periodic recessions. We'll have an occasional panic, which all recessions don't come from panics. But the good news is, if you look at the 20th century, in the 20th century, we had two world wars. We had the Great Depression. We had the flu epidemic. We had the Cold War. We had the atom bomb, you name it. The Dow Jones average went from 66 to 11,497, you know, with all these terrible things happening supposedly at various times. America works. And when I bought my first stock when I was 11, that was in the spring of 1942. And that was a couple months after Pearl Harbor. And we were getting clobbered in the Pacific at Corregidor and Bataan, I mean, the death march of Bataan. And in the European theater, the Blitz of England was on, and the Dow was at about 100. But just look at where we are now. I mean, the country really works. The trick is, I mean, it seems to me the obligation of a society as prosperous as ours is to figure out how nobody gets left too far behind. Right. But you don't have to worry about the system working. But you will have periodic recessions, and you will have an occasional panic brought on by something that who knows where it comes from. You know, the thing to remember at that time, I wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times in the fall of 2008, and I said, you know, that the country will come back. You know, it'll go through a big recession and everything, but it'll come back, and it's coming back.
Hi. Hi.
This is Carrie, and this is Eric.
Hi, Eric. Pleasure to meet you.
Good to see you.
So they're looking at this very pretty necklace here.
Uh-huh. I give a crazy Warren price on everything.
Of course.
Right.
Want a pen?
You bet.
There you go. But very good.
Thank you so much.
I think this might be something more interesting, don't
that
you?
It might be more interesting,
let's
yes.
Let's take a look.
Let's take a look.
Oh.
What do you think of that?
This is what I picked up.
Oh my God. Oh, wow.
You like it?
I love it. Of course.
Well,
I
think
love
you ought to try it on.
I think I'll do it.
You do it. You do the honor.
I love you with all my heart. You make me so happy. And I want to make you happy for the rest of our lives.
Oh my God, yes.
Will you marry me?
Of course I will. Oh, thank you.
Where does this populist instinct in you come from?
I was born lucky. You know, I was born in the United States of America. The odds were at least 30 to 1 against that. I didn't have anything to do with that. I was born wired for capital accumulation. I didn't have anything to do with that. So here I am. I won the ovarian lottery the day I was born. You know, a lot of people don't. You know, they go off to Afghanistan and fight for us to preserve things for me. I mean, I when some of my friends complain about their taxes, I feel like saying, let's continue this conversation on the shores of Normandy. You know, let's just go over there and we'll just talk about this, how terrible your situation is. And I really think this country works wonderfully on a market system. We don't want to give it up. We have to control that market system in many ways, but it works. It works with the kind of incentives we have. It works with equality of opportunity. It's not perfect, but we've tried for it over the time. But the lucky ones still prosper incredibly disproportionately, you know, under this. I'm not for having some kind of a czar in Washington that decides what's proper for everybody, but I do think something that thinks about the 60 million people that are living at $21,000 a year or less in their household. I think a rich, rich, rich society should think about them a little bit every day.
You've been famous for your investment strategy on basically that follows the opposite side of principles, invest when the chips are down and write it up. That served you well. So what's your favorite time that you were able to accomplish that, when you caught somebody down and moved
up? Well, I always think my favorite time is going to be tomorrow, you know, basically. It's always been fun, you know, and
there's a company here in Washington called Geico, you know, and I first got exposed to that in 1950. I was 20 years old, and I came down here, and I came down on a Saturday because I'd learned that my professor who I worshipped at Columbia named Ben Graham was the chairman. I got down here and the door was locked. When I went to the building, because it was Saturday, and I pounded on the door and some janitor let me in, and a marvelous fellow named Lorimer Davidson spent 4 hours with me teaching me all about insurance, and he helped me so much in life. You're gonna get help by some wonderful people in life. It's a great thing to remember later on when you get to be my age that, you know, all the help you've received from different people, because nobody does it alone. Obama got in trouble when he said that in the campaign, that, you know, nobody does it by themselves. Nobody does do it by themselves. We all sit in the shade of trees that were planted by others, so it's obligatory, I think, to plant a few trees ourselves if we've had good luck. It's been a great ride, but it's not over.
Would I be wrong to suggest the thing you worry most about is whether after you are gone that culture remains as it is, that you have in a sense made Berkshire strong enough to exist without you?
Yeah, I don't worry about that. I worried about it over the years, which is why I did a bunch of things that I think ensure that future. But that's always the question. I mean, you've seen all kinds of great companies topple for one reason.
You once said to me and to others, you have to make your company idiot-proof because at some point some idiot will run it.
Yeah, well, that may be even the case now. I mean,
but if someone has said, I think, that the thing you worry most about is whether Berkshire will be intact 20 years after your death.
I don't worry about it, but I care about it. Yeah, no, and since I care about it, I've put things in place which I think almost ensure that Berkshire will be a lot better 20 years after I'm gone than it is now.
Are there investments that you really wish you had never done? What's your worst investment?
I made a lot of terrible deals. And the worst, it's hard to, probably the worst deal will be one I make in the future, but the current title, I bought a company, and incidentally, I did it. I mean, we do not have PowerPoints around or people explaining this stuff to me. I just go out and do them. And we bought a company called Dexter Shoe. George Mitchell's here tonight. He knows the company. And we paid $400 million for it, which went to zero. But we paid $400 million in stock. And the stock we gave up is probably worth maybe $3 or $4 billion today. So whenever Berkshire goes down, I feel better about that deal. You know, why get involved in something where the decisions every day are terrible when you can get into a business where they're very, very easy? It's much more fun to sell Coca-Cola and everybody's smiling. As my partner, Charlie Munger, says, we haven't learned how to make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. We have enough trouble making silk purse out of silk.
You famously passed on Intel when it was getting started, I thought. And other.
Yeah, I knew Bob Noyce pretty well, and we bought it. We bought the converts when they were private, or just because of Bob. We bought them at Grinnell College, and the endowment of Grinnell College went from $8 million to $1 billion in about 12 or 14 years. So, and Intel was a help on that. But I, you know, in the end, I don't worry about things I don't understand. I mean, I think it was Tom Watson Sr. said, I'm no genius, but I'm smart in spots, and I stay around those spots, right. You know. And there's a lot to that. And knowing your circle of competence is where that perimeter is, right, is enormously important. And, you know, the fact that there's all kinds of things I can't do, and there's plenty of companies I can't analyze, but I don't have to worry about that.
You have said before that, to me and to others, that Berkshire is your canvas that you paint on. It's your masterpiece.
Well, I don't have masterpiece, but it's my canvas.
So what is it that, if you look at it today, Berkshire, you find fault with?
Find fault with?
Yeah.
Well, I made plenty of mistakes along the way, right. So I've got a lot of brush strokes out there that if I just give me a little whatever it takes to remove that, I would do it. So I made plenty of mistakes, but I expect to make mistakes, and I'll keep making mistakes. So.
Because unless you take chances, you won't make mistakes.
Oh, sure, and mistakes are part of the game. I mean, you're swinging at pitches, and you miss a few. But no, I don't want to sound too. I feel good about Berkshire. I mean, the people I'm associated with, the businesses, we have a
we lay out our economic principles, and I laid them out many, many years ago, and we don't change them. I mean, we try to operate that way. Doesn't mean we're perfection. You get a company of 260,000 people, I'll guarantee you right now somebody's doing something I wish they weren't. I mean, you can't have a city of 260,000 people and have no jails. But overall, I feel there's a culture that I don't think any other large, really large public company has, and I think it's enduring because it's so inculcated in the managers, the shareholders, the directors, everybody. So I feel good about Berkshire.
Of the investments you've made over the years at Berkshire Hathaway, which one would you say was the single best investment? Is there one that you really are most proud of?
Well, the one I'm probably the most emotionally attached to is GEICO because of a bunch of reasons, but it goes back to a day in January of 1951, a Saturday. And that, what Lorimer Davidson did for me changed my life. And he didn't have to do it. I mean, I walked in there as some 20-year-old kid on a Saturday, and he spent 4 hours educating me. And then he became a friend for life. And then subsequent people are Jack Byrne and Tony Nicely, who's here tonight. I mean, it's just been a wonderful association, whether we made any money or not, but we've done pretty well on the investment too. But beyond that, it has a special meaning to me.
The whole long-term capital management, and I hope most of you are familiar with it, but the whole story is really fascinating because if you take John Merriweather and Eric Rosenfeld, Larry Hillenbrand, Greg Hawkins, Victor Agani, the two Nobel Prize winners, Merton and Scholes, if you take the 16 of them, they probably have as high an average IQ as any 16 people working together in one business in the country, including at Microsoft or wherever you want to name. So there's an incredible amount of intellect in that room. Now, you combine that with the fact that those 16 had extensive experience in the field they were operating. I mean, this was not a bunch of guys who had made their money, you know, selling men's clothing and then all of a sudden went into the securities business or anything. They'd had, in aggregate, the 16 had probably had 350 or 400 years of experience doing exactly what they were doing. And then you throw in the third factor, that most of them had virtually all of their very substantial net worths in the business. So they had their own money up, hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars of their own money up, super high intellect, working in a field they knew, and essentially they went broke. And that, to me, is absolutely fascinating. I mean, if I ever write a book, it's going to be called Why Smart People Do Dumb Things. My partner says it should be autobiographical, but I... but this might be an interesting illustration. And these are perfectly decent guys. I respect them, and they helped me out when I was had problems with Solomon. And so they're not bad people at all. But to make money they didn't have and didn't need, they risked what they did have and did need. And that's foolish. That is just plain foolish. It doesn't make any difference what your IQ is. If you risk something that is important to you for something that is unimportant to you, it just does not make any sense. I don't care whether the odds are 100-1 that you succeed or 1,000-1 that you succeed. If you hand me a gun with 1,000 chambers, 1,000,000 chambers in it, and there's a bullet in one chamber, and you said, put it up your temple, how much do you want to be paid to pull it once, I'm not going to pull it. You know, you can name any sum you want, but it doesn't do anything for me on the upside, and I think the downside's fairly clear. So I'm not interested in that kind of a game, and yet people do it financially then without thinking about it very much.
Avoid credit cards. Just forget about them. We're in various businesses that issue credit cards. The American public loves credit cards, but if you start revolving debt on credit cards, you're going to be paying 18 or 20%, and you can't make progress in your financial life going around borrowing money at 18 or 20%. You can make a lot of money by lending it out at 18 or 20% over time, if you can find anybody that's good that will borrow from you. But you don't want to be on the side of the equation that's always behind in life. I was lucky. I'd saved about $10,000 by the time I got out of school. That $10,000 was really worth millions I might have earned later on, because after you get a family and everything, the expenses roll in. But those were my tools to work with, but it was only because I was ahead of the game. If you're behind the game by $10,000 at some point and paying 18 or 20% interest on it, you will never, you'll never get out of it. So the trick, I've got a partner that says, all I want to know is where I'm going to die, so I'll never go there, And
And that's true in financial matters as well. You want to figure out where you don't want to be ahead of time and avoid that. And I get about a dozen letters a day from people who are having terrible problems. And there are two reasons why they have terrible problems. One is a number of them have had health problems of some sort. I mean, they have really been hit by some, or somebody in their family has been hit by some kind of catastrophic illness. And that is a, you know, it's a terrible thing to happen to any family. And they get in, they run up bills they can't pay, and really only society can solve that one in terms of protecting people against that. That's just plain bad luck. But the other one is from people who run up credit card debt, and they're facing bankruptcy, or they've been through bankruptcy once before, and they owe a whole bunch of money, and they can't even pay the interest, let alone pay any principal. And half of my letters come from people like that, and that problem is avoidable. Catastrophic illness is not, but credit card debt is something you bring on yourself, and it's way easier to stay out of trouble than to get out of trouble financially. And I will guarantee you, if you run up big credit card debt, you will be in trouble probably the rest of your life in terms of your financial situation. On the other hand, if you get ahead of the game, even it's on a very modest scale, so that money is coming in from investing, and people owe you money, or equities owe you ownership, you'll be way ahead of the game compared to paying it, paying your creditors every month. So my advice to you is, if you can't pay for it, don't buy it, and get yourself in a position where you can pay for anything, and then we'll be glad to see you at Borsheim's or the Nebraska Furniture Mart.
I was wondering how you define success personally.
Well, I can certainly define happiness, because that's what I am. I mean, I get to do what I like to do every single day of the year, and I get to do it with people I like, and I don't have to associate with anybody who causes my stomach to churn. The only thing in my job I don't like, and this only happens about every 3 or 4 years, occasionally I have to fire somebody, and I don't like, that's the only thing. Other than I tap dance to work, and I get down there, and I think I'm supposed to lie on my back and paint the ceiling, you know, or something like Michelangelo. I mean, that's the way I feel, and it doesn't diminish. It's tremendous fun. So, you know, if they say that success is... getting what you want, and happiness is wanting what you get. Well, I don't know which one applies in this case, but I do know that I wouldn't be doing anything else. I mean, I do advise you, you know, when you go out to work, go to work for an organization that you admire, people you admire, because it'll turn you on, and you ought to be happy where you are working. And I always worry about people who say, you know, I'm going to do this for 10 years. I really don't like it very well, and I'll do 10 more years of this. And I mean, that's a little like saving up sex for your old age. I mean, not a very good idea. So get right in.
So you would recommend that.
Get right into what you enjoy, you know, and you'll be successful at it. You really will. I mean, you won't be able to miss. And, you know, that's... I don't regard what I do as the most important thing in the world at all, but it's right for me. I mean, I happen to be wired in a certain way that what I do works in this. If I had to do what, you know, Bill does, I mean, that lasts about 10 minutes. And that's true of a lot of things, but luckily I kind of stumbled into the thing that I do best, and that, you know, that it's worked out well. So I want a simple business, easy to understand, great economics now, honest and able management, And then I can see about, in a general way, where they're going to be 10 years from now. And if I can't see where they're going to be 10 years from now, I don't want to buy it. Basically, I don't want to buy any stock where if they close the New York Stock Exchange tomorrow for 5 years, I won't be happy owning it. I buy a farm, and I don't get a quote on it for 5 years, and I'm happy if the farm does okay. You know, I buy an apartment house, don't get a quote on it for 5 years, I'm happy if the apartment house produces the returns that I expect. But people buy a stock and they look at the price the next morning and they decide whether they're doing well or not doing well. It's crazy, because they're buying a piece of a business. That's what Graham, the most fundamental part of what he taught me. You know, you're not buying a stock, you're buying a part ownership in a business. You will do well if the business does well, and if you didn't pay a totally silly price. And that's what it's all about. And you ought to buy businesses you understand, just like if you're buying farms, you ought to buy farms you understand. It's not complicated.
I always look at IQ and talent as sort of representing the horsepower of the motor, but then in terms of the output, the efficiency with which the motor works, that depends on rationality, because a lot of people start out with 400 horsepower motors and get 100 horsepower of output, and it's way better to have a 200 horsepower motor and get it all into output. And so why do smart people do things that interfere with really getting the output they're entitled to? And it gets into the habits and the character and the temperament, and it really gets into behaving in a rational manner and not getting in your own way. As I say, everybody here has the ability absolutely to do anything I do and much beyond. And some of you will and some of you won't. But it will, the ones that won't, it will be because you get in your own way. It won't be because the world doesn't allow you to. It will be because you don't allow yourself to.
Because you made it this far in a video, I want to celebrate you. Most people start and don't finish. Most people never actually follow through. Most people say they want something, but they don't ever do the work to actually get it. But you are different. You are special. Believe Nation, you made it here all the way to the end, and I love you. So as a special celebration, if you put a hashtag Believe down in the comments below on this video, I will showcase you and celebrate you somewhere on the screen in a future video, because you are awesome. If you want to watch the world's best investors share their best advice, check the video right there next to me. I think you'll love it. Continue to believe, and I'll see you there.
I will never buy a stock in my life that doesn't pay a dividend. Yeah. If it's not returning cash to me, it's a speculation.
And in investing, I'm in a no-called strike business, which is the best business you can be.